Well, folks, even good things come to an end. And I don't know why any more than Nelly Furtado did in 2009, but here we are. Good news is, it's not like we have any loose ends to tie up, right? Right. This is The Option. Episode 6. The End Game. One of the first things we did on this series was look back at an old NCAA convention, and since we just had this year's in January, the first with new President Charlie Baker at the helm, it's only fitting that we come full circle. Take it away, Chuck.
I think it's really important that we remember that college sports is a uniquely American and uniquely amazing enterprise.
Easy on the mic, my guy. We're almost there.
Millions of adults believe to their core that the lessons they learned as student athletes changed their lives. And I hear the same message when I speak with today's student athletes. They are why we are all here. Their future is too important for any of us to just stand by and hope it's going to get better. And if we all do our part, get involved, do the work, play the hand, we can make progress on the large, complicated problems we face.
I read this in two contexts. On the one hand, this is a good but pretty boilerplate capper to a State of the Union address, which is what this is. He's saying what you'd expect to hear, and that's kind of the job, so hey, fine by me. The second one, though, and maybe I'm just reading in, but I think this was in the speech on purpose, is more revealing. It speaks to how Baker's approach has been different from his predecessors. It's this line right towards the end.
Their future is too important for any of us.
And this is the part I really mean.
To just stand by and hope it's going to get better.
Shots fired, maybe. I kind of think so. To me, it sounds like he's saying, we're not going to survive if we try and wait this out. And I take that as a not that subtle critique of how this organization has gone about surviving for a pretty long time now. The NCAA is not known for its proactive approach. It's generally tried to avoid even being reactive when it's been able to. For decades, this has been a very conservative organization that has gotten by with a pretty simple playbook. Remember Andy Coats, the lawyer from Oklahoma that we heard from back in episode 2? He took them to the Supreme Court, so take it from him.
We learned early that NCAA stood for never compromise anything anytime.
Yeah. And look, stubborn is not the worst way to be when you're trying to preserve something. And I still think the NCAA is trying to preserve something. But Baker seems to be wise to what Emmert and the rest of his forerunners weren't. In the absence of an antitrust exemption, which doesn't look forthcoming anytime soon and wouldn't necessarily solve all of their problems anyways, they're going to have to give not an inch, but several yards in order to save themselves the mile. They're playing prevent defense. That's how I see it, and it seems to be how Baker sees it too. Because basically everyone agrees on this, if nothing else. 10 years from now, maybe more like 5, this probably just isn't going to look like it does today. There are plenty of reasons for that. So let's start from the top. I'll just rattle off a couple, and maybe I'll ask for some help along the way. No particular order, by the way. But first complaint. Number one, the current system doesn't make sense. Door number one is pretty trendy. This isn't that hard to start picking apart, so a lot of people do. It's really a shame how many clips in our series have now been affected by Nick Saban's retirement, but if you'll bear with us, this is still a valid point from Colorado professor Sarah Fields.
If you look at, let's take Alabama, my guess is that Nick Saban in the football program probably makes 3 times as much as the athletic director, who probably makes at least twice what the university president does. And we go all the way down to the football players, without whom Alabama doesn't have a football team and they get paid nothing by the university. This is a kind of crazy structure. It only works because we claim it's educational. But is it really? We don't do this with other students who have skills, and we pay our other student employees.
And I think that's a fairly convincing takedown of a single school, but what about schools, plural? Got anything on that? The Athletics' Nicole Auerbach?
If you started college sports from scratch, you wouldn't set it up this way because the business model doesn't make any sense. You have a couple of sports that bring in the money that allow you to sponsor everything else. And you also have a couple conferences essentially bringing in a lot of the money that allows other leagues in the NCAA to sponsor everything else. Because if you think about the value of the men's basketball tournament and how that gets spread, you just have a lot of models and systems and finances that made more sense when it wasn't a multi-billion dollar industry.
And then zooming in on the biggest culprit in all of this, football, you've heard more people poking holes from within the sport than I can ever remember before. Now former UCLA coach Chip Kelly, everybody's moving this year, made some headlines on this speaking at a press conference a few months ago.
I think football should be separate from the other sports. Just the fact that our school is leaving to go to the Big Ten in football, our softball team should be playing Arizona in softball. Our basketball team should be playing Arizona in basketball. But because football left, and they're saying, well, how do you do that? Well, Notre Dame's independent in football, and they're in a conference and everything else. I think we should all be independent in football.
I could go on, as could Chip, but we've got more to get to, so let's go ahead and open up door number two. The current system isn't fair. You thought door number one was trendy. This is really hot right now. Hottest door in the club, bar none. Pretty much everybody's behind this one, but let's give the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay the first crack at it.
It's not a question of what's good for the game or what's bad for the game. It's just a question of basic fairness. And no other workplace would be allowed to maintain this sort of system, which is something the Supreme Court unanimously, very specifically pointed to, that the kind of controls that the NCAA had over its workplace were just absurdist compared. No other business would be permitted to work in this fashion.
And again, the people who are in this world think so too. Here's another man on the move, now former Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh, stirring it up before winning this year's national championship game.
The thing I would change about college football is to let the talent share in the ever-increasing revenues. We're all robbing the same train. And the ones that are in the position to do the heavy lifting, the ones that risk life and limb, out there on a football field are the players.
And that, while I give credit to coaches for getting on board, is also just a reflection of how an increasing share of the public looks at this issue. Northwestern's Jay Adonde says that shift has been dramatic and it's happened fast.
I'd say it's one of the great changes in attitudes that we've seen among sports fans. Whereas as recently as, I'd say, 6 to 8 years ago, there was a great reluctance to the notion of resistance to the idea that college athletes should be paid for their services. And now it seems to be there's overwhelming favoritism that, yes, these athletes should be paid because the money is so great now, the risks are high, their value has never been higher. This is, for the vast majority of them, this is the prime moments of their lives where they'll be capable of making money for playing sports. So, yes, it goes against all notions of fairness that they wouldn't be able to get money for their services.
And then you've got the slightly more concrete point of order behind door number three. The current system isn't legal. This might be the thorniest of the bunch, but I'm going to go ahead and say that it's pretty damn trendy too. Even Supreme Court justices seem to be in this camp, as Jeffrey Kessler, the lead attorney in the Alston case, reminds us.
And to quote Justice Kavanaugh in his concurrence in Alston, the NCAA is not above the law, right? And they're subject to the same antitrust rules when they're in business activities as every other business.
Now, Kessler is back with another major antitrust case, the House case, in which Grant House, our ASU swimmer from last week, is the lead plaintiff.
House is a case suing against the NCAA's NIL restrictions, and it has two components. One is relief going forward to prevent these restrictions either from coming back or continuing. For the past, we're seeking damages. And in every antitrust case, if you committed antitrust violations in the past, you are liable for damages for what you inflicted. So it's not retroactive, it's just damages. And so it's 4 years back from the time of the suit. And we are seeking damages for the fact that these athletes couldn't get these NIL opportunities in the past.
In November, the athletes were granted class action status for damages. And that means the NCAA could be on the hook for billions of dollars if they end up losing the case. That's probably the biggest threat to get back to the Supreme Court right now, too. So safe to say that's high on their list of problems. Then there's a case in Pennsylvania brought by a former football player at Villanova named Trey Johnson. We asked the lead attorney on that case, Paul McDonald, to lay out what they're arguing.
So Johnson versus NCAA is a very simple case. It basically makes the argument that college athletes, when you look at the criteria for student employees, meet those criteria as much as, and arguably more so, than fellow students who work in a work study and similar student employment programs. The kid who works in the dining hall, the kid who works at the library, the kid who works in the bookstore. That kid's being paid on an hourly basis on a minimum wage scale. Our case simply says that college athletes meet the same criteria as much as those kids do and should be paid an hourly wage.
To be clear, McDonald stresses his case is not even about granting student athletes employee status. That's a separate matter. But it's another one that is very much on the NCAA's radar, too, thanks to some recent movements on the labor front. That is a whole nother can of worms, going back to when players at Northwestern tried and failed to unionize 10 years ago.
The day of the student athlete may soon be over. Today, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that football players at Northwestern University are employees and therefore are entitled to a union.
It sure seemed like a major breakthrough. I remember a whole lot of discourse at the time, much of it pretty reminiscent of what we later saw in the wake of the Alston case. That's it. That is curtains for the NCAA. The fatal blow has been dealt. But as had always been the case until very recently, rumors of amateurism's demise turned out to be greatly exaggerated. Northwestern appealed that ruling, and by the following year, they'd won for good.
The National Labor Relations Board has dismissed a historic ruling that Northwestern University football players are school employees who are entitled to form what would be the nation's first union of college athletes.
And that reasoning ought to sound familiar by now. It's come up several times, but hold on. What's that noise? Did somebody leave a door open? Sounds pretty ajar from here.
The board seemed to leave open the possibility of taking up the unionization issue again if it involved other schools or if conditions changed for Northwestern football.
And if you've been reading the news lately, then you'll know that now it does involve other schools. Let's ship it up to the Granite State, shall we?
The varsity basketball team at Dartmouth College voted to form a union, the first college sports team in the country to do so, and a move that could lead to dramatic changes in college sports across the country.
That vote came down the day after we put out the series, by the way, so stellar timing. Thanks, guys. Almost exactly one decade later, it's Northwestern all over again. There's a ton of breathless coverage talking about what this means, and I don't begrudge anyone that per se, but Dartmouth is already appealing this too.
The college released a statement after the vote, which reads in part, quote, "The students on the men's basketball team are not in any way employed by Dartmouth. For Ivy League students who are varsity athletes, academics are of primary importance." The statement went on to include, quote, "Classifying these students as employees simply because they play basketball is as unprecedented as it is inaccurate."
So there's that. Although, sort of along the lines of what we were talking about with Reggie Bush a few weeks ago, the backdrop's awfully different now compared to 2014. This could go differently. We don't know yet, though we may find out soon. And speaking of Bush, there's a whole separate NLRB complaint out in California, accusing his alma mater, USC, the conference that it once belonged to, the Pac-12, prayers up, and of course, the NCAA, of unlawfully misclassifying college athletes as student athletes rather than employees. But there is a theme to the three schools that we've been talking about, though USC is a little less obviously part of the group. I did have to Google it, I'll admit. Northwestern, Dartmouth, and USC are all private universities, not state schools. And that presents a different kind of hurdle that would greatly limit the impact of this, even if Dartmouth were to succeed.
There is a very practical legal barrier, which is that many states are allowed to have laws that prohibit their state institution employees from being unionized. And many of the states with the biggest schools have such laws. So like you could not unionize, the athletes at Texas, even if they otherwise qualified, unless you got a federal law passed that would preempt those state laws.
Some states, like Ohio and Michigan, home to two pretty big state football schools, passed laws specifically excluding college athletes right around the time the Northwestern business was going on in 2014, which seems a little dastardly in retrospect. I digress, though, to return to a running theme here on our program. If it's federal legislation that you need, I sure hope you're not in a hurry. And while the wait for congressional intervention continues, there are always more cases against the NCAA pouring in at a steady clip, more than we could possibly cover here. The point being, not just on the legal front, but really on all three that we just went over, the NCAA is an organization that has been on the back foot lately. And that's the context for Charlie Baker going rogue.
I think that he and some of the people that he's brought in have realized pretty quickly, like, hey, the structure's pretty messed up.
That's Ben Portnoy, a college sports reporter for Sports Business Journal.
There's some stuff going here that we need to fix, and we need to fix it now, and we can't really sit on our hands and wait. And I think that that's the thing, the sort of ability to be out in front on some of this stuff as best they can, right? Like, you inherit a problem when you inherit it, right? And I think that for Charlie Baker, like, he inherited a kind of sinking ship on a lot of levels. And you look at that and you try to turn that forward and say, okay, what's the path forward? And I think that that's where you get a proposal like this, right? That's where you get something that drastically changes how the NCAA is going to think and operate about things.
Baker's saying as much out loud, just like his speech that we heard at the top, urging leaders in college sports that they can't just stand by and hope things get better. It's time to get proactive. So here we are, getting proactive. And that is quite the shift. It's probably giving the NCAA too much credit to call it sudden, but it is a big change. And I don't want to just gloss over that either.
The basic pillar of the NCAA, quote unquote, has been we're not going to pay athletes because they're amateurs. Charlie Baker has basically said, actually, yeah, we are. Or we're going to find a way to do it. Or we're going to find a more direct way to make this work. Because in all reality, these student athletes are making money and probably deserve to have some cut of the pie in some capacity in some way. And I think it's such a fundamental and monumental shift in just the way of thinking at the NCAA. But again, because this has been the way of thinking for 100+ years, that creates sort of this gap that you have to mend and say, like, guys, this is not how we can operate in this modern era.
Now, to be fair, the intent to change is a good start, but that's all it is for now. There's a long way to go, and this is gonna get messy. It's like the draft text for a bill in Congress. You're really just trying to offer a framework. Then everybody comes in with their own constituents and interests, and all the horse trading hopefully gets you somewhere that enough people can agree on to pass it, even if it's far afield of where you started. Baker acknowledged that himself in a recent sit-down with ESPN.
First of all, it was a conversation starter. I mean, I'm, you know, having come from the world I came from, which was politics, if you want to start a conversation, you make a proposal, and then you say to other people, what do you think? And that was the point of it, and it certainly has engaged a lot of discussion. So from my point of view, this was, let's start a conversation about how to think a little differently about D1 generally, and to create a framework that creates a more autonomous process for some of the more highly resourced institutions, with the idea that eventually we would probably have to get Congress to enable this to take place.
And you'll notice he's careful to include that last part. We can only do so much to clean up our own house. We're gonna need Congress to help us out with the courts. And that puts a true resolution somewhat out of reach, at least in the short term. Like I said, don't wait up. But hey, look, I know what your question is, because it's mine too. Where does this all end up in the long term? The truth, obvious though it may be, is I don't know. Nobody does. But I can lay out a couple of scenarios. So first, let's take the more skeptical angle. Even now, change is not guaranteed. Antitrust suits are not exactly the fast track to progress. Those wheels turn awfully slow, and sometimes they get stuck on the tracks. That's what Rick Karcher, a professor at Eastern Michigan, thinks about all this.
I mean, the money and resources that a law firm puts into a class action lawsuit, it's not an efficient way to get anything done here. It really isn't. The antitrust lawsuits are not really you know, accomplishing.
Maybe not the most expedient way to go about affecting change. Yeah.
Right. No, they're just not. They never have been, and they never will be in sports. In fact, they haven't really been at the professional level, to be honest with you. Antitrust lawsuits really haven't done from a labor, from a player perspective, right?
Rick says the NCAA isn't nearly as afraid of antitrust lawsuits as a lot of people would have you believe, simply because this is not their first rodeo.
They have been sued so many times, and not just on antitrust claims, but lots of other, you know, legal claims, right? I mean, so in other words, it's part of doing business for the NCAA. It really is. And so for anybody to think that, you know, the NCAA is going down or they're afraid of, you know, antitrust lawsuits is, I mean, it's just a ridiculous concept because they've been fighting antitrust lawsuits. Before I went to law school, they were fighting antitrust lawsuits.
So that's the calm down perspective. He's among those who think the impact of the Alston case has been overblown and the present model will find a way to survive with the bare minimum in concessions. We can't rule that out. What I would suggest as the most likely outcome is that the rough contours of Baker's proposal actually do come to pass. A subdivision of Power 5 schools starts setting aside real money for paying players. They'll call it a stipend or something as opposed to a salary, but that's essentially what it would be. It's not a hot take, by the way. It's openly acknowledged. The new AD at Texas A&M, Trev Alberts, put a ballpark number to that idea in his introductory press conference just a few weeks ago.
You look at all the professional organizations, the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, and most of them are roughly 50-50. So I think we'll get some credit for what we're doing on the back end. It won't be 50%, but if you model some of the numbers, depending on how it gets allocated, you're looking at between a $15 and $20 million number, not one time, annually. Going forward, that'll be a new expense category that athletics are going to have to deal with.
For him, this isn't much of a hypothetical. It's an eventuality, and his job is to be prepared. While that's happening at giant programs like Texas A&M, I would bet that everyone else outside of that subdivision of schools largely stays the course, finally and officially separate from this wildly different top end of things. Remember, this is the NCAA here. Changing it all is pretty new, so we shouldn't be surprised if it's incremental. And that would be a pretty sizable increment. If you're projecting further forward, though, then you start to get into some bolder possibilities. First, there are plenty of details that you can start adding to color in the Baker framework. For instance, here's a thought from Georgia Tech basketball coach Damon Stoudemire, who says that some kind of pay scale would help regiment that kind of new arrangement.
I mean, we're in a day where there is enough money to be paid where there should be compensation. I think that in each sport, there should be a tier level and there should be a mandated tier level. It should be everybody involved on that tier level. So what does tier one look like? That's your best players. Tier two, you know, the next player, tier three, tier four, however that looks like, right? But I think that, you know, to keep not even the integrity of the game, because I think that, you know, again, you could pay anybody what you want. That's your prerogative. But my point is that it should be tiered to keep other schools competitive.
And then you continue allowing players to pursue NIL deals on their own time, which continues to mirror the professional level.
At the end of the day, it's no different than being a pro. When you go pro, there are some people that get shoe deals and some people that don't. I think that if people's brand is big enough to go get additional monies, they should be able to go get additional monies.
He didn't call it this, but since other coaches have, paging Rick Pitino, this starts getting into salary cap territory. That is a step we could see, but it does call back to another step possibly on the horizon. If it's a pro-style setup that you're looking for, a union would go a long way toward getting there. It won't be easy to come by, as we already explained, but people like Ithaca College's Ellen Starosky think it's a necessary step.
And when we're talking about reform, I actually honestly don't think that there will be meaningful reform until there is a separate entity that represents the interests of the athletes. I think that's when we're going to have meaningful reform. And until such time, until that happens, I think we're just going to see this system continue to morph and have these strange things happening as the people in power try to maintain as much control.
And then, one step further after that, you've got the most radical of all the possibilities we've touched on. And this one's provocative, so you might want to take a seat. We already heard from Colorado's Sarah Fields earlier, so maybe she ought to lead us in. A familiar voice. Easy does it.
It might require us rethinking and going back to, why do we have college sports to begin with? No other country in the world has invested in as much sport in their educational system as we have. Why have we done that? The purpose was not to make money. The purpose was that it was going to be educational. Because having taught at big sports schools with powerhouse programs and had students in those programs, I've had football and basketball players at OSU in Georgia. Sometimes they have to really fight to get the education that they want. So they are very much athletes first, students second. And maybe we should change that.
I feel an obligation to couch all of this by saying this still works in most contexts. I want to keep making that point so it doesn't get totally lost in all of this. But where it doesn't work, and we're admitting that, in this D1 subdivision that Charlie Baker wants to create, for instance, if that does happen, it could also become a staging ground for something pretty root and branch.
I'm of the belief that where we're going in college sports is probably toward the division of college sports from the academics at universities.
That's Dennis Denninger again from Syracuse University.
And that would probably be across the FBS and very likely across Division I, in that, yes, we have this group that is affiliated with our school, but it's a different entity. It's a subsidiary. We're not going to call them student athletes anymore. They're athletes. So I really think that we may see a model that starts to approach more of what the rest of the world has, in that, okay, this is a separate club. You can still call it the Ohio State Football Club, but it's no longer part of Ohio State. And hey, some of the football players might want to sit down on classes, but they don't have any requirements anymore, because their requirements are laid out by their club to perform in their football roles.
Teams will still carry the school's name, and they'll still have the old uniforms, and you'll still see Ugga the Bulldog on the sidelines struggling to overcome generations of inbreeding. But they won't be tethered to the educational institution in the same way they are now. Strange? Yes. Plausible? Weirdly, yes. Dennis is right to point out that much of the world already does this. A lot of European soccer and rugby clubs work like this already. So look, I don't know when or if the American collegiate system ever goes for that. That's so different that I wouldn't expect anything like it anytime soon. I would just underline that a lot of previously unheard of steps feel a little more possible now. And though this isn't one that Charlie Baker wants to hear, one of those possibilities is that the NCAA as we know it continues to lose power until it just kind of wastes away. Football breaks off even more than it has already, and takes their ball with them. Then the major conferences, which are largely formed around that sport, follow, until there's just not much left. That's not that crazy anymore. That could happen. The NCAA could become a far less influential organization, responsible only for the lower tiers of D1 as well as D2 and D3. Maybe it would be better off in that way in some sense. Or it could be replaced by a smattering of different, smaller organizations, each tasked with running their own little corner of the landscape. All of that is on the table. The NCAA's biggest asset remains March Madness. That's not going anywhere at the moment, but some think there's cause for concern on the horizon, even there, as Fox looks to launch a rival to the NIT in Vegas. That may sound like small potatoes. It's just a rival to the NIT, after all, which, for those who don't know, is the postseason tournament for the teams who don't make March Madness. However, the NIT used to be a way bigger deal than it is now, and as college basketball writer Eamon Brennan explains, this move could ultimately be more about the blueprint.
It's about concept rather than execution in this instance. The NCAA tournament, the biggest threat to it for forever now has been the idea that college conference commissioners, particularly power conferences, and their TV partners would just at some point say, you know what, why are we given all these at-large spots in the, you know, of the 68 teams, why are so many going to mid-major teams that for us don't move the needle or whatever? that has always been kind of brushed aside. The NCAA tournament's amazing. We love it. But maybe we could expand it and some of those spots could go to, you know, some more mediocre ACC teams. But look, we're not going to destroy the thing. But the contours of how it would get destroyed are exactly what Fox is proposing for this tournament. The only difference is instead of targeting the NCAA tournament, it targets the NIT.
And if you think that could never happen, then I'd encourage you to take a look at football, where it already has.
If the NCAA tournament ever is going to get destroyed and execs and conference commissioners basically take over the process the way they have with football, this is how it's going to look.
Now, there are plenty of reasons not to do this. Like Eamon points out, March Madness is universally beloved. I can think of few sporting events with the same level of public approval ratings across the board. It might be the best postseason in sports, period. Plus, there's a broadcast deal in place until 2032, so nothing like this would be happening anytime soon in theory. But if Fox and the major conferences, or any other similar combination, were to pry the tournament away from the NCAA, that could be it. In keeping with another theme of ours on this program, that leaves us in a pretty ambiguous place. Some people are optimistic about what's coming. Others are pretty worried. Some are kind of both, and I know I've thrown a ton of stuff at you in the last 30 minutes or so, and I am sorry about that. It's been breaking my brain too. And when you're in this deep, you start looking for sure things. And one of the few things that does seem clear now, as compared to years past, is that things are actually moving. Stagnant is just not a word that comes to mind these days. When we spoke to the Washington Post's Ben Strauss, who wrote a high-profile book on all this in 2016, and the book was called Indentured, by the way, so that should give you a sense of what he made of the landscape, he pointed out that the things that he thought were changing as he was writing the book actually started shifting only in the last few years.
When the book came out, it was after the O'Bannon ruling had been somewhat neutered. It was after the Northwestern Union movement had somewhat fizzled. And it was unclear sort of what the path was to large-scale reform. And it seemed like sort of the Death Star had won in a lot of ways. And so I have to say I'm probably somewhat surprised that with the amount of change and the amount of movement that's happened in the last few years, because sort of just in how well sort of the establishment weathered some serious legal challenges, serious player challenges, and it was ultimately these state legislatures passing laws that brought the NCAA to its knees, that really ushered in the end of amateurism as we knew it.
Writers and reporters like us are one thing. It's a little harder to get a truly representative vibe check from athletes and coaches, but I think the closest we'll get is the cautious optimism, emphasis on cautious, that we heard from Stoudemire.
And the only thing I ask myself every day when I wake up is what we're doing in college a sustainable model? That's the only thing I ask. You know, the factors that are in play now, I just think that if we're going to continue down the path we're continuing, there just has to be a sustainable model of how we do that. I think that what happens is in college and collegiate sports at times is there's not enough people on the same page in terms of maybe trying to find a common goal and a common ground.
And that absolutely remains a concern. Consensus building is no easy business. And nothing about this gets any simpler the closer you get to what we might tentatively call a resolution. There is so much to work out here, and enough things that have changed for the worse, not the better, to temper pure optimism. What I think and really believe, though, is that this consensus around the most glaring issue in college sports, a basic unfairness in its very top echelon, has been building for much of my life now. It goes back to what Jay Adande was saying earlier. People didn't always feel this way. I would say pretty confidently that public opinion, more than any other single force, has produced the changes that we're seeing today, which I do take to be more good than not, however flawed. So, if you'll forgive me getting on my West Wing flow here a little bit, which doesn't come easy these days, it's a reminder that there is really nothing more powerful in a democratic society than what people think. If you can change minds, you can change just about anything. That is what is happening. And no, I don't presume that to mean that the entire system is broken. It's not. I think there's plenty that essentially works now. Those who are less progressive on this issue aren't crazy to be concerned that fixing the squeaky wheel could total the car. I just happen to think, maybe naively, that it's actually not impossible to have this both ways. Carve it out. We're already doing it. There is a path forward here. That's not to say it's a straight line. It will take time, probably a lot of it. There will be fits and starts. There will continue to be problems. There will be unintended consequences. And yet, things will keep changing. Maybe, even, before they have to. You never know. That could change too. I mean, don't bet on it, but it could. Tell you what, we'll keep an eye on it. The music you heard in this episode comes from Epidemic Sounds. Production and sound editing by Joe Engelbrecht and Dean Metherill. Cover art by Sam Ball. And I'm your host, Michael Hendricks.